The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Dane Mutter. He joins us on the telephone in Dayton. Hello, Dane.
Hi, Vic.
I assume you're in Dayton. Are you in Dayton?
We are in Dayton, yes. Okay. Actually, it's Clayton, but our address is Dayton, so just confusing sometimes.
Clayton, huh?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. And are you still near a river?
We are, right in front of the Stillwater River.
I bet you like living close to a river.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Well, Dane, you've just put out a new book, and it's a collection of some newspaper articles that you wrote a number of years ago. It's called Nature in Dayton, an anthology. And I'm going to guess that some of our listeners probably were not aware of this column. Tell us about the column. When did it run? How did it happen? What was it about?
It seems that we were on a canoe trip, and Gene Capel, who was a columnist, was along, and I don't know, we tipped over or something significant happened. And on the way, I told her I'd like to write. She said, well, why don't you write some articles and send them in? And apparently she gave them to Jim Nichols, and Jim picked it up and said, okay, we'll add the column Downtown Naturalist to the Downtowner.
And what was the Downtowner?
Well, that was a kind of a supplement to the Dayton Daily News, which came out weekly, and a lot of advertising and various columns.
And you wrote mostly about nature, and you seem, in the columns in this collection, you seem to be kind of amazed when you see certain creatures in Dayton. What are they doing here? Where'd they come from?
Really, we invaded their territory, but we kind of look at it the other way around. You see a red fox in the center of downtown Dayton, you think, "Well, this is weird, strange." You shouldn't be here.
So you went back and you picked out some selected columns. How did you decide which ones to put in this collection?
Oh, that's the tough part about an anthology, is just sort and sort and sort. I mean, you've already written this stuff. It's just a matter of picking up what do you want to do now? You know, what part of that stuff you've written do you want to get out there again? So you sort and sort and sort and end up with an anthology.
Well, Dane, I know you've been on the planet for a while, and you've got quite a long history in our area. Tell our listeners who you are. Where'd you come from? How did you get here? And what kind of stuff have you been doing over the last 90 years or so?
That's quite a request. Well, born in Morrow County up in near Marengo, Ohio. Probably no one has ever heard of Marengo.
Uh-huh.
Near Mount Gilead, up in kind of north, a little bit northeastern Ohio. And my parents moved to Indiana on a farm out there owned by one of the local colleges. And we were out there 14 years, so I actually grew up in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I was a Buckeye by birth. So, I guess that pretty well sums up my illustrious history.
Well, what have you done since then, since you were a kid in Indiana? I'm sure you've done some interesting things that our listeners would love to hear about.
Well, I was a big fan of 4-H, 4-H clubs. Were for mostly at that time, and still for rural kids, you know, to take a project and work under a leader, and complete a project and show it at the county fair, and kind of learn to be competitive. in a real sort of way.
Uh-huh.
And so I took a number of different projects, beef cattle and dairy cattle and rabbits and probably several others I can't think of right now.
And this is when you were a teenager?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, 4-H, you could remain in clubs, I think, up until maybe 17, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the last time I talked to you, you were still at Allwood. Is that right?
Right, yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So tell us how you ended up in Dayton and the kinds of activities you've taken part in since you've been here.
Well, let's see, from Allwood, trying to think of the transition situation here. Mine is just going blank. Ask me something else.
Okay. Well, I know you've been involved with the Metro Parks.
Yes. Uh-huh.
You want to tell us about that?
Well, I was looking around for a position. I didn't care for where I was working at the time. So I started looking around, and I went to Pittsburgh, looked for a job there, and nothing quite available. I went to Chicago, a couple of places in Cook County, and looked for a place, and nothing there. Came back to Dayton, and Dick Walwill, the director of the parks, said, we have an opening coming up soon. Maybe we can put you on as had an odd title. It was the chief of the Rural Life Center, and he wanted to develop a sort of a place similar to Allwood Children's Farm at one of the south parks, like Possum Creek Reserve.
Uh-huh.
So and that's how I got involved there.
Okay. Well, I understand back in the early 80s, when it was still the Park District of Dayton-Montgomery County, now Five Rivers Metro Parks,
right,
that you were involved in looking at how they manage their natural areas to maximize biological diversity.
Yeah.
And back then the philosophy was the best plan is no plan at all, but you recognized that things needed to be done differently. What did you decide needed to be done?
Well, I think at that point we decided that some management was necessary, that if you just let things go, like plants like multiflora rose, which were non-native plants, would move in and take over an area.
Mm-hmm.
So some management was necessary to keep, a balance, kind of a rhythm of different habitats going.
And that philosophy was embraced and has continued.
Pretty much so. It's a natural thing. It just flows the way nature is intended, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to work, so we've stuck with it.
Well, you just mentioned invasive plants like the multiflora rose, which has invaded my yard out in the country.
Yeah.
And I like it when it blooms, and then the rest of the year, get rid of it. You have a column in here that you wrote back in 1986 called Hitchhikers, Alien Life Forms Travel with Humans, Colonize. And in this one, you're talking about some of those invasive plants.
Uh-huh.
And you also talk about something I didn't know about the camera they took to the moon. I didn't know this story.
Uh-huh.
There was bacteria inside it?
Yeah, some of the junk we've left scattered around.
Somebody had sneezed when they were putting together the camera, and the bacteria went to the moon and back, and it was still alive.
Yeah. Odd things happen.
Uh-huh. Okay. You had another one in here. I can't remember the name of the essay, where you're talking about someone admiring some beautiful flowers down by the river.
Oh, yeah.
And you recognized that these were another invasive.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about that?
if I can think of the names that I can't think of right now.
Some beautiful, I think it was yellow flower.
It was yellow, and one is, it's found around wetlands, swampy
right.
areas.
It's like a member of the buttercup family. Was it lesser celandine?
It could be, yeah.
Okay.
Celandine, and then there's another plant that looks just like it, which doesn't fit in anywhere.
Is that the marsh marigold?
That would be, yeah, uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I imagine butterflies like them whether they're invasive or not.
I think the butterflies aren't that discerning. As
okay.
long as the sap tastes good to them, they'll go ahead and use it.
Well, I know that there's been a movement here in recent years, long after you wrote these columns.
Uh-huh.
I thought about it because you wrote a column in 1989 called Milkweed's Bitter Milk Tastes Sweet to Insects and Butterflies.
Oh, yeah.
And I know a lot of people now are concerned about the monarch butterflies that feed on the milkweed, and they've been planting milkweed to try to encourage them.
Yes. Uh-huh.
The monarchs apparently are in some trouble.
They are in trouble and could possibly become extinct.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm talking to Dane Mutter about his anthology, Nature in Dayton, and we'll continue our conversation right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with my guest Dane Mutter. We're talking about his new anthology, Nature in Dayton. When you wrote all these columns, how did you get the idea for each one? Would you just be walking along and suddenly think, I'm going to write about that?
That's a real good question. If you're facing, you know, of course, about this yourself, if you're faced with each week I had to produce something.
Uh-huh.
I had to come up with an idea. Where do I get the idea? Well, just go out and walk around a little bit, and once it pops into your brain, or you see something move, and you go see what it is, and you say, okay, I'll write about that.
Uh-huh.
So it's about as simple as that. No real hard planning goes into it.
Well, these are some beautiful essays.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And I'm guessing that you spent a lot of time on a bicycle. Am I right?
Used to, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I do now.
Not too much now?
Now maybe a tricycle.
Okay.
I've been looking at a tricycle as a possibility.
Uh-huh. Well, they're probably a little easier to pedal when you're pushing 90.
They are, and they don't tend to tip over as easily.
I think one of my favorite essays is the one, Squirrels Find Their Hidden Cache. Do they
uh-huh.
sniff it out, or is it memory?
Yeah.
What do you think? Do the squirrels remember where they bury the nut, or do they smell it?
I don't think they have that much memory. I believe it's mostly smell.
Uh-huh.
I could be wrong. It's hard to test. That's a hard one to test. You know, how do you set up an experiment with squirrels?
Well, I can usually tell when a squirrel forgot where the nut was because a few years later I'll see a walnut tree come popping up and I'll say, where'd that come from?
That's one way a lot of trees get planted. Yeah, a lot of trees. Uh-huh.
I live out in rural Greene County,
uh-huh.
and I can tell that sometime, must have been 170, 180 years ago, somebody planted a row of white oak trees.
Oh, yeah.
And most of them are dead now. There's only a couple of them are still alive. One of them is in my yard, and it's huge.
Uh-huh.
And it stopped producing acorns a number of years ago. It just didn't drop any more acorns. And I thought, man, this tree is so old, it's not even putting out acorns. Well, this year, I found three or four acorns that have fallen out of that tree. Now,
I'll be darned.
Now, what do you think? Do they stop producing acorns when they get to a certain age?
I don't know, Vic. That's a good question. You wouldn't think they would, because that's basically how they reproduce their own species.
Yeah, but you get to a certain age, and if this tree is 200 years old, maybe it's just not interested anymore.
Well, that's kind of the way with human beings.
Well, the squirrels maybe have been beating me to it, and I just have not noticed. And they've been eating them all before I could get them. But I picked up several acorns, and I'm going to try to get them to grow because I want this old oak tree to have some babies.
Good. That's terrific. Yeah. Good luck on that.
Now, what's the best way to germinate an acorn?
Well, I would put it in moist soil and leave it out where there's plenty of light and just let nature take its course.
Okay. So you think I should leave it outside to freeze in the winter in the soil? Would that be something that would want?
Because in nature, they do have to freeze for a period of time, I'm sure, before they would germinate.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think you're on the right track there.
All right. Well, I don't know anything about it, Dane. I'm flying blind here. Okay. Do you have a favorite essay in here, in this book?
Gosh, no. Favorites are very hard to come by.
Okay.
And no, I don't have.
Okay. I loved your one about the chimney swifts. Do they still come into Dayton like they used to?
Yeah. I don't know of any basic change in their population. Uh-huh.
You know, you talked about almost 1,000 of them circling around this chimney and coming into roost, and they apparently were flying in from somewhere else. They were migrating?
Yeah.
And so there's room for 1,000 of them. Is that chimney still around? Was it at a church?
I believe it was at the big old church that used to be up on Salem Avenue.
Oh, so that chimney's gone.
Unitarian First Church, I believe it is.
Uh-huh. Okay. Wow.
Now, they'll still come back to where the chimney was for a period of time, and I guess eventually they give up on it.
You've got another great column in here about the time the bat flew into the arcade.
Oh, yeah. That created quite a stir, yeah.
Well, some people don't like bats, but I learned something from your essay. Bats apparently are very clean, very, very fastidious groomers.
They are. And they're very easy to get. If you get one in the house, all he has to do is open a window, and they echolocate. You know, they'll find an opening. They'll circle maybe a time or two, but they'll finally go out.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. That's all you need. Just get him out of there.
And you want those bats out there flying around because they eat lots and lots of mosquitoes.
Oh, tons of mosquitoes, yes. Yeah.
Now, are the bats another species that's kind of having a tough time?
They are. Yes, they are. Uh-huh.
How can we create habitat for them?
Well, you can buy, you know, there are bat houses you can buy and put up, and some of them will be used. So that's one thing you can do. At least you think you feel like you're doing something.
Uh-huh.
And they will use some of the artificial houses.
Now, Dane, I heard a rumor that you've been involved with the Beaver Creek Wetlands Association. Now, weren't you the executive director?
Yes, yeah.
And you didn't mention that when I asked you about your resume, Dane.
Oh, I forgot about that.
You forgot, huh?
Too many details.
Now, I also heard a rumor that if we were driving around Greene County, we might pass a prairie with the name Dane Mutter on it.
That's right, yeah.
You've got a prairie named after you?
I do, uh-huh. Yeah.
What an honor.
I figured it quite an honor. Yeah, I felt that way. Uh-huh.
Why did they name it after you? Did you have something to do with preserving it?
Probably had something to do. I really can't answer that. I don't know what was in there, what they were thinking.
You're a humble guy, Dane. You okay. Now, weren't you also the director of the Upper River Fund?
Yes. Yeah, that was Glenn Thompson's money.
Uh-huh.
Glenn had accumulated quite a fortune, and he was mistaken. He thought the Upper River was part of the Great Miami, and really the Upper River was referring to the Little Miami, which is two different streams,
uh-huh.
Two different watersheds, in fact. But Glenn didn't realize that. And so, nonetheless, we had quite a nice amount of money in the Upper River Fund with which we purchased easements and bought some land.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was put to good use.
So you're creating a green belt?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And tell us about Glenn Thompson. I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know who he was.
Well, Glenn was a feisty editor of the, I believe, the Dayton Journal, I think.
Dayton
Journal Herald. That's when we had two papers.
You know, right.
Daily News and Dayton Journal Herald. And I think Glenn was the editor of the journal. And he pushed the... old-timers referred to him as the father of the Park District.
Oh.
He pushed the necessary buttons to actually create the Park District, Dayton-Montgomery County Park District.
Well, he must have been sort of ornery to get away with that.
He was a bit ornery.
Was he?
Feisty guy. And,
yeah.
A fellow you didn't want to tangle with, really.
Uh-huh.
But he put it across.
Now,
so, as I say, the old timers around still refer to Glenn as the father of the park district.
Okay. And I understand you were also involved with getting the Stillwater River nominated to be a state scenic river.
Right, yeah. We worked hard on that. We had quite a good committee of people working on the Stillwater Scenic River and finally got it through as a scenic river.
Well, I heard a story from somebody, Dane. I'm trying to remember who it was, but somebody told me you went to a meeting for the turning that into a state scenic river, and you were meeting with some of the local landowners, and one guy who was sitting at the table pulled out a gun and set it down before he started talking. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah.
What was that all about?
I was trying to think that the issue got pretty hot, and I think he was just showing that he had the power to maybe change things.
I guess so.
No matter what.
All right.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't a very nice situation.
I see. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. It's the Book Nook. My guest is Dane Mutter. He has a new book out. It's called Nature in Dayton, an anthology. And the Christmas bird count, do they still do that?
As far as I know, we haven't gone on it for a while, but I think it's sponsored by National Audubon, and I think Allwood is involved in it. And it's sort of a good index on what's around. You know, it's the middle of the winter.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of raccoons. You could... You've got an essay in here about raccoons, and you seem to like them.
I love them. Yeah.
Okay. What do you like about them?
They're clever little animals. I'll tell you, they are pretty smart when it comes to figuring out problems. And they're survivors, and they just seem to get along fine.
And they can survive anywhere.
They seem to survive well. Weather can change quite a bit, and they get right on through it.
I also kind of get the feeling from reading your book that you're a cat lover.
To an extent.
To an extent?
Lover is a little bit strong.
Okay.
We have cats. We have too many. I always say too damn many cats. We have six.
You have six cats now?
And they just sort of come around here and stay and seem to like it here.
I guess the food's good, huh?
Food must be good. And unfortunately, our chipmunk supply is going down the tubes.
Oh, they catch the chipmunks.
Pretty well cleaned out the chipmunks.
Mm-hmm. They do that, don't they?
They work on some of the birds, too, whatever they can catch.
Yeah, and we don't like that, do we?
Don't like that, but still we got them around.
Well, I've got eight cats, so.
Boy.
So I understand what you're going through.
Yeah, well, that's a bunch of cats.
Now, am I going to guess correctly that maybe the person who lives in the house with you is a big cat lover, and you just kind of put up with them?
I think my wife probably likes cats better than I do.
Okay, I just want to clarify that.
Right. Yeah.
Because in my house, it's kind of the opposite. But she's starting to like cats because she has to.
Yeah.
we used to have 13 cats.
Oh, my God. Oh,
well, we live in the country, and you know how they just turn up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you live in an area where people just drop off cats? I mean, how are you getting yours?
Yeah. They drop off and come up from who knows where, and you just see a different cat, and first thing you know, he's eating out of your food dish. He's been in the house, and he's sitting up on the table looking at you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, and this brings us to your essay, Nice or Not, House Mice Certainly Are Numerous. And that's why you have the cats.
That's one reason we have the cats, yeah.
Well, I read your statistic in here that showed how they reproduce.
Yeah.
And you wrote in here, they breed from early spring to late fall and can raise 5 to 10 litters each year with 5 to 8 babies per litter.
Yeah, when you do the math on that, you get some pretty large numbers.
Well, that's one mother mouse having 80 babies a year.
Yeah.
And then those babies, after 6 weeks, they are capable of reproducing.
Yeah.
That's a lot of mice.
That's a lot of mice. But they are at the bottom of the food chain.
Yeah, they are prey, aren't they?
They are prey, so it kind of balances out, you know, as time goes by.
Now, is it true that the house mice are not native to North America?
I am not sure. I think that's probably true.
It sounds like they're from Asia originally, according to this essay.
I believe, uh-huh.
That's amazing. And then you also talk in here about one of my favorite songbirds, a much maligned songbird, the starling.
Good old starling. I'm a favorite. That's one of my favorite birds.
I love the way they improvise. I've never heard a starling sing the same song twice.
No, they're good. They're good mimics. They do a good job of mimicking other birds, and I'm sure there's a reason for that, but they get by okay.
Well, they're truly amazing.
They are.
And speaking of birds, okay, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you about some birds because I think you know something about the peacocks at the Cox Arboretum.
Yeah, let's see. Oh, there's a whole story there that's way out of my mind.
Okay. You know something about them, though, huh?
Oh, yeah, I do remember. They come. First of all, they seem to travel all over the neighborhood, and people would call in. Some people would call and say, get these damn things out of my yard. And other people would call and they want them. They wanted them.
Uh-huh.
So they have people on both sides of that fence.
Well, they can be kind of obnoxious.
They can. We used to have neighbors with peacocks. They'd fly over here and poop on our deck.
There you go.
And then you'd go out and shoot them and they'd fly back. And then at night they'd squawk and squeal and scream and carry on. So you could hardly go to sleep.
Uh-huh.
Just crazy birds.
Well, we had some neighbors that had peacocks.
Uh-huh.
And then down the road, we had some other neighbors that moved out of their house, and they were trying to sell it. And they couldn't figure out why it wouldn't sell. But what they didn't know was that the peacocks from down the road, every time someone came over to look at their house, they would be up on the roof doing what peacocks do.
Yeah.
And these people were like, why would I buy a house with peacocks on the roof doing that?
I know, and they'll just hop from rooftop to rooftop and carry on.
Well, Dane, this is a very nice collection, and can people find this, like if they go on Amazon? Where can they find this?
Well, they can call me.
They can call you?
Me if they want.
Okay, well, you want me to give out your phone number, Dane?
I'm sorry?
You want me to give out your phone number?
That would be okay, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if you want to talk to Dane about the book, Dane, you're going to regret this.
Yeah.
The number is 937-898-3495.
Gotcha. Allwood will have them.
Okay, Allwood will have them. All right.
Cox Arboretum.
Okay.
The various Park District bookstores.
Excellent.
Will have them. So they're out there pretty well available in a number of different places.
All righty. Well, Dane, it's really been nice talking to you again. Thank you so much.
Great talking to you, Vic.
The book is Nature in Dayton, an Anthology. Dane Mutter wrote it. And, Dane, I hope you have a real nice birthday.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Vic.
You take care. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and my guest was Dane Mutter. We talked about nature in Dayton, his new anthology. And we have a little extra time on the program today, and we're at that point in the season, in the year, just as we're entering autumn, when we have lots of ripe apples all around us in the Miami Valley. And I'm going to bring you a special bonus segment talking about apples with Ben Watson right after this. The Book Nook continues with a special bonus segment. A number of years ago, I talked to a gentleman named Ben Watson about his book, Cider, Hard and Sweet, History, Traditions, and Making Your Own.
You start off the book with history of apples, and I was fascinated by this. Tell us about apples and where they came from and why they're such an all-American fruit.
Well, they're an all-American fruit, but actually they come originally from... There's research that's been done that shows they came from Central Asia, from the old former Soviet Union, around Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzia was where the first things of what we would, first examples of what we would call the domesticated apple came from. And they worked their way along to the Middle East and into Europe. And from there, when they took off back in the time of the Romans and the Greeks, they were cultivated and became the home orchard kind of fruit that we know today, and then from there got translated to America, where they've really flourished. America has a huge number of unique varieties that came from people planting seeds of apples and finding just, you know, what came up and saving the best varieties. Those are some of our greatest apples.
Now, this was a revelation to me. I was totally in the dark on this. I just assumed when you plant an apple seed, you got the same kind of apple.
No, in fact, you almost never get the same kind of apple. In fact, I think you could say that you never get the same kind, because apples cross-pollinate so readily with not only, you know, domestic apples, but also with crab apples and other things, that they're all hybrid seeds, and you'll come up with something that's totally different from the parent. The only way to get carry on a true variety of an apple is to take a graft or a cutting of the tree and to graft it onto another tree.
And people figured this grafting out a long time ago, I take it.
Oh yeah, the Romans were doing it, and probably even earlier than that, but the Romans really were the first to codify it and write it down as to how to do it. But it's kind of neat, because it does mean that genetically speaking, the same fruit that the Romans were eating, or that they were eating back in the 16th century, maybe in France or Britain, if you've got that same variety and it's remained true, you're really eating the same kind of apple that they ate.
Ben, you talk about the history of cider at the beginning of the book, and it seems to me that when cider arrived in England, when apples arrived in England, that this was a big step for cider.
Yeah, England is one of those places. They're all over Northwest Europe, actually. England, the West Country of England, is a big area for hard cider making, and it was a very patriotic thing to make cider back in the 17th and 18th centuries, because by that time people had cut down a lot of the trees in England to put up houses, and as opposed to making beer, which takes heat, you need to have heat to boil the wort and to malt the barley. You didn't need that with apples, and they sort of went hand in glove with the need for wood. You planted the apple trees and harvested the apples, and you could make cider, and then when the trees were finally all spent, which could be decades later, you could actually use them for firewood or for whatever you needed to.
And 200 years ago, you say that one in every 10 farms in New England owned and operated its own cider mill, and that Americans were consuming massive quantities of cider. What happened?
There were three basic things that happened to cider. After the Civil War, there was one thing that occurred was that people started to move into cities, a trend that only recently has really turned around. But the urbanization of the country meant that people weren't operating their own farms and making their own natural, fresh farmhouse cider. And another thing was that there was a lot of immigration from Germany and a lot of the Scandinavian countries, where the drink of choice was beer, and a lot of breweries started up late in the 19th century. And finally, there was the whole temperance movement, too, that spelled the death knell to hard cider for at least a few years back in the early 20th century. And really, some small farmers carried on the traditions in New England and around the country, and they've really carried it on uninterrupted since then, but it's been very an underground thing until recently.
Let's talk about the different kinds of cider, starting with the one people are familiar with.
The fresh cider, the sweet cider, is the one that most people are most familiar with.
Okay,
and that's obviously the product. It's not what you find in the, at least in my estimation, it's not what you find in the supermarkets, because what's in the supermarket has been pasteurized and usually has preservatives in it, so that it will have a longer shelf life. But if you go out to an orchard and you've ever tasted real cider, you really know what the genuine article is. And that's just basically apple juice that's had a chance to sit around for a day or so and to develop that dark, rich color and opaque quality to it. It's very different from apple juice. So that's your basic, and that's the basis of all good hard cider, too. I mean, it takes a good fresh cider to make a good hard cider.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other popular kind, and what's really sparked the renewed interest in cider, is that there's been a lot of promotion over recent years of various draft ciders that are sold in six-packs, like beer, mostly. Brands, there are national brands like Woodchuck Cider, which is made up here in Vermont, and other ciders like Cider Jack, which is also a Vermont cider, but there are a few other national brands.
There's even one from Cincinnati. I think Hardcore is from around here.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a very good hard cider, actually. I mentioned that in the book, and it's not a bad draft cider at all. But that's just one style of hard cider. People think that that's what hard cider is, and if they don't particularly like that, they'll say, oh, I don't like hard cider. And I sort of compare that to somebody saying, because I don't like Astu Spumante, therefore I don't like wine. And no one would say that. And by the same token, there are a lot of different styles of cider that are perfect for everybody's taste. And that's just one small example of the kinds of cider that are out there.
Ben, you point out that there are a number of apples that are used by cider makers in places like England and France that are actually fairly unpalatable to eat as apples. I was not aware of these type of apples until I read your book.
Yeah, they're not very little known in the United States, but they're terrific for making hard cider, fermented cider. But you wouldn't want to eat them because they're very bitter. They've got a quality in there. They've got tannin in them, which is the same thing that makes think of sucking on a tea bag. That's what tannin is like. That's what you get from sucking on a tea bag. So they're very astringent or bitter, and you really can't eat them as fresh fruit. But they make terrific hard cider when you blend them together, because that same tannin is the same thing that gives a wine or a cider body. It really makes a very clear, nicely fermented beverage. And the exciting thing is that people are starting to grow these apples in America now. In fact, a friend of mine who's an orchardist up here in New Hampshire has just planted, I think, what's the largest planting of traditional cider apple varieties probably in the Western Hemisphere. He's just put in about 40 acres, and he's taking a huge gamble by doing it, but I admire him for taking it on.
Wow. I bet that cost some money.
It did, and they're doing very well, and I think he won't have any trouble in 4 or 5 years when they start bearing, selling these apples to all of the cider makers that are going to be around at that time.
My guest is Ben Watson. His book is Cider, Hard and Sweet. I loved your story about Jesse Hyatt back in 1872 in Piru, Iowa, and how he had this apple tree that was basically a volunteer, and he kept trying to cut it down.
Yeah, it was the original Red Delicious apple. He didn't call it that. He called it Hawkeye after the state of Iowa, of course. And he did try to cut it down three times, and finally he got sick of doing that because it kept growing back, and he sent it in to Stark Brothers. They had a competition. They were still going back then. It's one of the nation's oldest nurseries. And they loved it so much that they were they offered it for sale and grew it out back in the late 1800s, I think about 1894, and they introduced it as delicious, because that was what how they described it. They changed the name. They bit into it and they said, "My, that's delicious." But now there are literally hundreds of varieties of Red Delicious apple, and it's not one of my personal favorites. I think for real apple fans, it's you know you think of the stuff that you get in the supermarket, which is very mealy and rather tasteless and unobjectionable, but not really superior in any sort of way.
Well, the apples that dominate the industry are the ones that have a long shelf life, that are easy to reproduce, I would assume.
Well, also the ones that, not even so much that have a long shelf life, although Red Delicious does, but you can keep a lot of apples in storage. I mean, orchardists keep them in what's called controlled atmosphere storage, which means that there's nitrogen gas instead of carbon dioxide in there. And you can store apples for a long time that way. But, you know, really, appearance is the thing. I mean, people will often opt for, and I do the same thing, even though I know better, I'll pick up a Red Delicious apple sometimes just because it looks so nice. But that isn't always indicative of taste. Some of the best apples I've eaten look like ugly potatoes. they're brown and russeted all over, and they look totally unappealing, but you take a taste of them, and it's like you've died and gone to heaven. They're sugary and sweet and dense and just a wonderful taste.
Now, as we get into the heart of the book, you talk about how we can make our own cider, and I was very impressed. I felt like I could make my own cider after reading your descriptions. Tell us the basics of how we can make cider.
Well, I tried to keep it simple because, like with as with anything else, it's easy to get started in it, and it's a very simple thing to do, but you know, obviously, as you get more experience, you get more sophisticated in doing it. But basically, you don't have to make a big expenditure. I think that's one of the beauties of this. You can go out, you can use recycled gallon glass wine jugs if you want, which is what I have used in the past and still do sometimes. And, you know, just some vinyl plastic tubing. Go out and buy a few things like that, a few plastic airlocks, which will cost you maybe a dollar a piece. And basically all you need to do is just to pour the cider into one of these vessels that you're going to use for fermentation. You have to keep everything clean. That's about the only ground rule, just as you do for making beer or wine or anything. Just keep it sanitary. And it pretty much, that's the basic process. You let it go on its own. It'll start to ferment. And when it subsides a bit, then you put on an airlock and just let it keep the air away from it for 2 or 3 months or 4 months, and you've got hard cider. You don't have to add yeast. You don't have to add anything else. The yeasts will come in from the apples on the skins and flesh of the apples. You can make perfectly nice and very tasty hard cider with natural yeasts.
You also have a very amusing description of how to make applejack, but you say purely for historic purposes. Explain.
Well... Yeah, Applejack, what's sold as Applejack these days, there's a brand, one national brand, which is really apple brandy mixed with some neutral spirits, you know, it's distilled. But the old way of making Applejack was to put a barrel of cider or a cask of cider outside and let it freeze during the coldest days of the winter, and then to draw off the inner, put a hot poker down through the bunghole of the cask, and draw off the interior cider, which would be concentrated, and it would be about the strength of, oh, I don't know, a good Madeira wine or something, so maybe 15% alcohol. And it's good stuff, but boy, you don't want to drink very much of it, because a lot of the impurities, since it's not distilled, are concentrated in the middle of the barrel. So you could get some epic hangovers from drinking that stuff, and it's not recommended. And it's also, incidentally, illegal. The
right.
Government doesn't like anybody to do it.
That's right. It's illegal. So don't you ever do it. Ben, there's a particular malady that people used to suffer from drinking that, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was called apple palsy, and it's not very pleasant. It comes from a lot of the impurities that are in Applejack. There are a lot of aldehydes and esters and things that you don't really want in your system. And if you drank enough of it, you could definitely suffer from bad consequences.
And that was our Best of the Book Nook bonus segment, recorded a number of years ago, talking to Ben Watson about his book, Cider, Hard and Sweet, History, Traditions, and Making Your Own. How do you like them apples? I've got a special announcement for you coming up tomorrow in the Book Nook. You won't want to miss this. At 10:30 on Sunday morning, I'll do my first ever interview with Ken Follett. He's just published The Evening and The Morning. Ken is a mega best-selling author, and there's good reason for that. He's a great writer. I'm going to read you the beginning of his new book as he introduces his main protagonist, a guy named Edgar. And the date is Thursday, June 17th, 997. It was hard to stay awake all night, Edgar found, even on the most important night of your life. He had spread his cloak over the reeds on the floor, and now he lay on it, dressed in the knee-length brown wool tunic that was all he wore in summer, day and night. In winter, he would wrap the cloak around him and lie near the fire, but now the weather was warm. Midsummer day was a week away. Edgar always knew dates. Most people had to ask the priests who kept calendars. Edgar's older brother, Ermin, had once said to him, "How come you know when Easter is?" And he had replied, "Because it's the first Sunday after the first full moon after the 21st day of March." Obviously. It had been a mistake to add obviously, because Ermin had punched him in the stomach for being sarcastic. That had been years ago when Edgar was small. He was grown now. He would be 18, 3 days after midsummer. His brothers no longer punched him. He shook his head. Random thoughts sent him drifting off. He tried to make himself uncomfortable, lying on his fists to stay awake. He wondered how much longer he had to wait. He turned his head and looked around by firelight. His home was like almost every other house in the town of Combe. Oak plank walls, a thatched roof, and an earth floor partly covered with reeds from the banks of the nearby river. It had no windows. In the middle of the single room was a square of stones surrounding the hearth. Over the fire stood an iron tripod, from which cooking pots could be hung, and its legs made spidery shadows on the underside of the roof. All around the walls were wooden pegs on which were hung clothes, cooking utensils, and boat-building tools. Edgar was not sure how much of the night had passed because he might have dozed off, perhaps more than once. Earlier, he had listened to the sounds of the town settling for the night. A couple of drunks singing an obscene ditty. The bitter accusations of a marital quarrel in a neighboring house. A door slamming and a dog barking. And somewhere nearby, a woman sobbing. But now there was nothing but the soft lullaby of waves on a sheltered beach. He stared in the direction of the door, looking for telltale signs of light around its edges, and saw only darkness. That meant either that the moon had set, so the night was well advanced, or that the sky was cloudy, which would tell him nothing. The rest of his family lay around the room, close to the walls, where there was less smoke. Pa and Ma were back to back. Sometimes they would wake in the middle of the night and embrace, whispering and moving together, until they fell back, panting. But they were fast asleep now. Pa snoring. Ermin, the eldest brother at 20, lay near Edgar. And Eadbald, the middle one, was in the corner. Edgar could hear their steady, untroubled breathing. At last the church bell struck. There was a monastery on the far side of the town. The monks had a way of measuring the hours of the night. They made big graduated candles that told the time as they burned down. 1 hour before dawn, they would ring the bell and then get up to chant their service of matins. Ken Follett, the opening of his new one, over 900 pages. What a read. It's called The Evening and the Morning. And I will have Ken Follett on the program. If you're a Ken Follett fan or you know someone who is, let them know. He'll be on tomorrow morning at 10:30 right here on WYSO. We'll be calling him at his country home just outside of London. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for listening and for supporting WYSO.